Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much to the quartet. It's an annual favorite here in Indianapolis. Very meaningful, powerful words. Appreciate that. I think the first split sermon and this one will tie very well together, very different perspectives and direction, but a common theme of looking back to then look forward. As we transition from the Passover observance last night through the portion of the Passover day during which Jesus was crucified and into the first day of unleavened bread that begins this evening at sunset, it's a good time to draw some lessons from what the disciples experienced on the other side of the 3 days and three nights in the grave that Jesus had prophesied for himself, and that began as this Passover day drew to a close. There are multiple indications in the gospel accounts of Christ's last Passover showing that the disciples didn't clearly understand what was happening. Some examples include the argument over who would be the greatest among them, recorded in Luke 22. This was after they had already taken the newly instituted symbols of bread and wine. Later that night, as Matthew 26 records, there was the untimely sleep as Jesus prayed and struggled with the reality of what he was about to endure. Still later in the evening, as described in Luke 22, when the authorities came to arrest Jesus, they reacted by attempting to defend Jesus by force. Despite the disciples' lack of understanding about what was occurring, the events that were prophesied and ordained as part of God's plan of salvation did happen. And soon the disciples found themselves as confused spectators, trying but failing to somehow make sense of it all. Let's go to Luke 23. Luke 23, near the very end of the crucifixion here, starting in verse 46, it says, "And when Jesus had cried out with a loud voice, he said, 'Father, into your hands I commit my spirit.' Having said this, he breathed his last." Verse 48, "And the whole crowd who came together to that sight, seeing what had been done, beat their breasts and returned." Verse 49, "But all his acquaintances and the women who followed him from Galilee stood at a distance, watching these things." Those who knew Jesus and followed him were watching as one of the most critical events in God's plan occurred in real time, right in front of them. But as we will see, they didn't fully grasp that in the moment as it happened. One of the main reasons for this was simply that they were not expecting the death and resurrection of the Messiah that they had been waiting for. So in the time that we have remaining, let's review the first half of Luke 24. Definitely, if you have a Bible marker, you want to put it there in Luke 24, with a special focus on how the events that unfolded did not match what the disciples expected. And let's draw some lessons that can leave us with transformed expectations for the work that God is doing in our lives right now during the Feast of Unleavened Bread that we're about to observe. So for those of you who are normally here, this is definitely a departure from my normal speaking style. We don't have points or anything. We're just going to go through the first half of Luke 24 and make some observations along the way. So Luke 24, starting in verse 1. It says, "Now on the first day of the week, very early in the morning, they and certain other women with them came to the tomb, bringing the spices which they had prepared. But they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. Then they went in and did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. And it happened, as they were greatly perplexed about this." The New Testament Greek lexicon at BibleStudyTools.com, this is the source for all of the definitions that we'll review from the biblical words today. It states that the word translated as perplexed here means to be entirely at a loss. So the women who arrived that morning were beyond a bit confused, as we might say, utterly stunned in the sense of mouths hanging open and eyes staring in disbelief would probably be a better description in our modern vernacular for how they reacted at finding the empty tomb. Continuing in verse 4, after they were perplexed, that behold, two men stood by them in shining garments. Then, as they were afraid and bowed their faces to the earth, they said to them, "Why do you seek the living among the dead? He is not here, but is risen. Remember how he spoke to you when he was still in Galilee, saying, 'The Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men and be crucified, and the third day rise again.'" Verse 8, "And they remembered his words." So here the angels who were present at the tomb began to help bring the events of the previous weeks and days together for the women who were there trying to make sense of it. They remind them that Jesus had specifically talked about the very things which had now come to pass, and with this reminder, the women begin to remember what Jesus had said. Jesus had foretold his death and crucifixion multiple times. One of those occurrences is in Luke chapter 18, and I'm going to read this from the English Standard Version. Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 31. It states, "And taking the 12, he, Jesus, said to them, 'See, we are going up to Jerusalem, and everything that is written about the Son of Man by the prophets will be accomplished. For he will be delivered over to the Gentiles and will be mocked and shamefully treated and spit upon. And after flogging him, they will kill him, and on the third day he will rise.'" Verse 34, "But they understood none of these things. The saying was hidden from them, and they did not grasp what was said." The word translated as hidden, as the English Standard Version has it there, can have both the implication of something being intentionally concealed and something escaping notice. And it's likely that both elements were true in the statement that they did not grasp what was said. The word grasp provides a powerful picture. The illustration is of an attempt to hold something with the hands, but it slips through your hands, slips through your fingers. You can't grasp onto it. The two things that contributed to this inability to correctly perceive and process what was heard and what was seen were, first, that God wasn't ready to fully reveal it, and second, the disciples had faulty expectations, and they were looking for the wrong things. Both of these elements continue to play out as the women return to share the events at the tomb with the other disciples. Back to Luke 24 and continuing in verse 9. It says, "Then they," the women, "returned from the tomb and told all these things to the 11 and to all the rest. It was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and the other women with them who told these things to the apostles. And their words seemed to them like idle tales, and they did not believe them. But Peter arose and ran to the tomb, and stooping down, he saw the linen cloths lying by themselves, and he departed, marveling to himself at what had happened." So the initial reaction from the rest of the disciples, as the women shared what they had witnessed, is one of disbelief, and more characteristic of someone who is hearing things that are just totally unintelligible to them. You can imagine a lot of squinting and maybe somebody rubbing their temples. It's just totally unintelligible. The Expositor's Bible commentary summarizes that the apostles, in their incredulity, were unable to comprehend the reality of what the women were trying to convey. Similarly, William Barclay's commentary points out that the word translated as idle tales or nonsense, as it has it in the New King James margin. It says of this word, it was employed by Greek medical writers to describe the babbling of a fevered and insane mind. So clearly, the news that the women returned with had nowhere to land. They brought a clear and simple report of Jesus having been resurrected, but their report was lost in a fog of confusion for those who were receiving it. Luke's account shows that Peter went to see for himself. John's account adds that another disciple, many commentators believe it was John himself, went as well. John points out in his account that the other disciple saw and believed when he went into the empty tomb. Expositors points out that Peter left the tomb wondering to himself, or marveling to himself, as it's in the New King James here, it's wondering to himself in the NIV, and that this phrase does not imply in itself either belief or unbelief. So in other words, Peter wasn't very sure what to believe and wasn't very sure what had actually happened. So how was it that the disciples didn't understand what had happened? It's quite easy for us to ask that question as though the outcome would have been different if we were there instead of them. As, you know, we talk about armchair quarterbacks after the football game on Monday morning. It's easy for us as armchair disciples to, you know, see here in the scriptures Jesus had told them what would take place. The women told them what had happened after hearing it from angels. The evidence was there in the empty tomb. Sounds simple, straightforward. Well, not really from their perspective. Again, we'll see the same two things preventing the disciples from fully grasping what was occurring, even though it was happening right in front of them. So here the first element is preventing full understanding in that things were occurring very differently from what they expected. The Nelson Study Bible's comments on these verses state matter-of-factly, skepticism reigned among the disciples. It is clear that they did not expect a resurrection. And few things generate confusion and misunderstanding as quickly as any form of dissonance or variance with what we expect to happen. Another of the multiple instances when Jesus foretold his death and crucifixion is in Matthew 16. Let's go to Matthew chapter 16. Matthew 16, verse 21 says, "From that time, Jesus began to show to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised to the third day." Verse 22, "Then Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, 'Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you.'" So here Peter was almost certainly just voicing what the rest of the disciples were thinking or saying amongst themselves. "What are you talking about? This can't happen to you, Lord." The path that Jesus was taking wasn't the path that they expected the Messiah, the anointed one, as Mr. Snyder spoke about, to take. In his book titled "The Obstacle is the Way," author Ryan Holiday explains many of the basic principles of Stoic philosophy in a fairly easy-to-consume manner. In a chapter titled "Practicing Objectivity," he writes, "How many problems seem to come from applying judgments to things we don't control as though there were a way they were supposed to be? How often do we see what we think is there or should be there instead of what actually is there?" Very relevant questions for us as we begin to pursue growth and spiritual maturity after having examined ourselves in preparation for the Passover. How often do we see what we think God is doing or should be doing in our lives instead of what he actually is doing? How often do we see what we think he is doing or should be doing as he works out his plan of salvation for all mankind. Again, instead of what he actually is doing. There are many, many times in life when we would like to just fast forward beyond whatever challenge or discomfort or fatigue we may be experiencing. But often we find, usually with the benefit of hindsight, that God was continuing his work within us. He was continuing his work in circumstances around us and not letting those circumstances go to waste. When it comes to our spiritual development, we very often find another principle articulated by Ryan Holiday, that there is opportunity inside the obstacle. As we continue on in Luke 24, we'll see that the disciples were perplexed in part because they were focused on what should have happened from their understanding, from their viewpoint. There was a large gap between what they expected and what happened, and it clouded their perception. Their first view of the things that they had witnessed was as an obstacle to the fulfillment of God's plan. They saw what was happening as something that was getting in the way of what really should be happening. In reality, it was the preordained way that God's plan was to be accomplished. Jesus needed to open their minds to the massive opportunity inside of what they were viewing as a massive obstacle. Let's go back to Luke 24. Back to Luke 24. And continuing in verse 13. It says, "Now behold, two of them were traveling the same day to a village called Emmaus, which was 7 miles from Jerusalem. And they talked together of all these things which had happened. So it was while they conversed and reasoned that Jesus himself drew near and went with them. But their eyes were restrained so that they did not know him." So here we find the second element that prevented full understanding, which is that Jesus Christ chose the timeline for opening their minds and revealing the true meaning of what was happening. Reviewing several Bible translations helps to reinforce that aspect of what was occurring. So the King James Version has that first portion of verse 16 as, "But their eyes were holden so that they should not know him." The English Standard Version has, "But their eyes were kept from recognizing him." And in William Barclay's translation in the New Daily Study Bible, it says, "But their eyes were fastened so that they did not recognize him." So the word translated in these various versions as restrained, holden, kept, fastened, as these words imply, it means to take hold of or to keep in check. There's a very strong indication of directional control over the outcome. And in this case, the outcome was the ability of the disciples to grasp and understand what they were seeing and what or who was in front of them. There are two other occasions after his resurrection where Jesus' followers did not recognize him. One of those is John's account of the women who came to the tomb and found it empty. We read Luke's account. Let's notice what John wrote in John chapter 20. Now this was after Peter and the other disciple had already arrived and left the scene of the tomb. John 20, starting in verse 11, it states, "But Mary," this is Mary Magdalene, "stood outside by the tomb weeping, and as she wept, she stooped down and looked into the tomb. And she saw two angels in white sitting, one at the head and the other at the foot, where the body of Jesus had lain. Then they said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' She said to them, 'Because they have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.'" Verse 14, "Now when she had said this, she turned around and saw Jesus standing there and did not know that it was Jesus." Mark's account records this as well and adds some vital details that help in understanding the lack of recognition. Let's go to Mark 16. Mark Mark chapter 16. Starting in verse 9. It says, "Now when he rose early on the first day of the week, he appeared first to Mary Magdalene, out of whom he had cast seven demons. She went and told those who had been with him, and they mourned and wept. And when they heard that he was alive and had been seen by her, they did not believe. Verse 12, after that he appeared in another form to two of them as they walked and went into the country." Notice the first portion of that verse especially. He appeared in another form. So these are the two disciples who were walking to Emmaus. Verse 13, "And they went and told it to the rest, but they did not believe them either." So this passage reveals the additional detail that Jesus had taken on another form, as verse 12 states. The word "another" means not of the same nature or different, and the word "form" means external appearance. That word "form" is the Greek morphe. Our English word "morph" is essentially the same word, meaning to change form or to transform, according to Merriam-Webster. So as Jesus made these first appearances to Mary Magdalene and then to Cleopas and the other unnamed disciple as they walked to Emmaus, it is clear that he took on a different physical appearance temporarily. Now, why would Jesus Christ prevent these followers that he first appeared to from immediately recognizing him? There's no doubt multiple reasons that we could explore, but let's focus on one that aligns with our topic today. The accounts that we've just read in John and Mark clearly highlight the reaction of the disciples who heard the eyewitness reports of those who had seen Jesus. They didn't believe the firsthand testimony of their companions. Again, they were not operating based on the reality of what was occurring around them, but on their perception of that reality, on what they already felt about it in their own hearts and minds. So in these temporary changes of appearance, Jesus was doing what God has always done, opening the understanding of those that he is working with at the best time for them to understand it. God does not manipulate the choices of human beings to achieve some rigged destiny or some rigged outcome that can only end one way. But he does at times magnify what is already occurring in our hearts for a purpose. The disciples didn't expect the Messiah to suffer and die and then be resurrected. By appearing in a different form, Jesus allowed them to continue in those existing expectations until the moment that he chose to reveal himself and bring the needed change in their thinking. How often does God work within our lives in perhaps the same pattern? Perhaps he is often present in our lives, working to develop spiritual maturity well before we are at a place where he can reveal it and help us and allow us to fully recognize it. Throughout the Bible, we can see that God controls the timing of revelation for all of us. We can be thankful that he opens our hearts and minds to the truth at a time and in a way when we can fully grasp and understand it. Back to Luke 24, continuing in verse 17, it says, "And he," Jesus, "said to them, 'What kind of conversation is this that you have with one another as you walk and are sad?' Then the one whose name was Cleopas answered and said to him, 'Are you the only stranger in Jerusalem, and have you not known the things which happened there in these days?' And he said to them, 'What things?' So they said to him, 'The things concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people. And how the chief priests and our rulers delivered him to be condemned to death and crucified him.'" Verse 21, "But we were hoping that it was he who was going to redeem Israel. Indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened." The Nelson Study Bible's comments on verses 19 to 21 state simply, the disciples had hoped that God would once again save Israel through Jesus. And when we stop to consider the national history of Israel and later Judah as well, that hope is understandable. The stories of Israel and Judah are filled with many deliverers. Moses, the judges, King David, Josiah, Ezra, and Nehemiah, just to name a few. The prophets had foretold a far greater deliverer to come, but it would have been easy to kind of interpolate that into a deliverance more akin to what had already happened in their national history. How often do we limit what God is capable of doing in our lives by seeing it through a fairly narrow lens of what has already happened and what we've already experienced? We all have obstacles in our lives that we can't seem to do anything about, don't we? Maybe it's an illness or a health condition. Maybe it's one or more relationships that are strained or broken. Maybe it's a habit or an element of our character that we can't work up the courage to face and overcome. Maybe it's all of those things. Our natural path in the face of these obstacles is to continue operating based on what we know. And that survival mechanism has a time and a place in our lives. But there are also many times when we need to move beyond the familiar and allow God to reveal paths forward that are available to us over and around and through the obstacles that we struggle with. As the disciples peered apprehensively into this uncertain future following the unexpected death of their leader, they had forgotten, and we also often forget, his own words. Let's go to Luke 18. Luke chapter 18. We'll break into something that Jesus stated as he was speaking to the disciple after a particular event. Luke chapter 18, verse 27 says, "But he, Jesus, said, 'The things which are impossible with men are possible with God.'" That bears reading again. The things which are impossible with men are possible with God. In the depths of our struggles, it can be very difficult to take these words at face value. In spite of that, we can take comfort in knowing that this wasn't just a superficial phrase that sounded good without really meaning anything. Jesus Christ said this after having been the one, as Mr. Snyder was pointing out as well, who brought about the miraculous and life-changing work of God recorded in the Old Testament. As the Messiah, God in the flesh, he also received that miraculous and life-changing support from God the Father that allowed him to fulfill his purpose. It's also worth considering that Jesus wasn't the first to make such a statement. There are many examples of God's faithful servants who believed, but yet had struggles the same as ours, but they believed that nothing is impossible with God. One example is found in Jeremiah 32. Jeremiah chapter 32. This is a particularly meaningful example because of what was occurring. Jeremiah 32 and verse 17, Jeremiah writes, "Ah, Lord God, behold, you have made the heavens and the earth by your great power and outstretched arm. There is nothing too hard for you." Here again, a phrase that can easily sound like it's, you know, just too far up in the clouds to really mean anything. But it meant something to Jeremiah. When he wrote it, he had just purchased land that was under siege and about to fall to the Babylonians, on the promise earlier in chapter 32 from God that houses and fields and vineyards would be possessed again in that land. And they were possessed again in that land when God brought his people back from exile and the Babylonian captivity. In that and so many other cases, as Jeremiah wrote, nothing is too hard for God. But when Jesus was crucified, it seemed to his disciples that all was lost. Returning to Luke 24, if you want to flip back there, back in Luke 24, starting in verse 20, Cleopas describes how Jesus had been betrayed and crucified. And then those poignant words, but we were hoping. And that shows the disciples' fervent hope that he would at that time be Israel's deliverer. In another chapter titled Think Differently, in the book The Obstacle is the Way, Ryan Holiday writes about how our mindset can obstruct our view of the way forward. He states, our perceptions determine to an incredibly large degree what we are and are not capable of. In many ways, they determine reality itself. When we believe in the obstacle more than the goal, which will inevitably triumph? When we believe in the obstacle more than the goal, which will inevitably triumph? In the problems of our own lives, it can definitely feel as though all is lost. So often we need God's help to change our perception of those problems that we can't seem to do anything about. Just as the disciples here on the way to Emmaus, we need to be shown the reality stated by Jesus in Matthew's account of what he had said, that with God, all things are possible. Notice again, at the end of verse 21, that Cleopas states, indeed, besides all this, today is the third day since these things happened. As we read in verses 6 and 7, the angels reminded the women at the tomb of what Jesus had said. The disciples traveling to Emmaus knew very well how many days had passed, but they had forgotten what Jesus had said about what would happen after those days passed. Continuing in verse 22 of Luke 24, Cleopas continues, yes, and certain women of our company who arrived at the tomb early astonished us. When they did not find his body, they came saying that they had seen a vision of angels who said he was alive. Verse 24, and certain of those who were with us went to the tomb and found it just as the women had said, but him they did not see. Nelson Study Bible's comments on verse 24 summarize that, quote, as far as the disciples were concerned, there was still no decisive proof of Jesus' resurrection. They wanted to see the resurrected Jesus. And it's hard to miss the irony here at the end of the verse that Cleopas was lamenting with this statement, him they did not see, to Jesus himself. These two disciples were at that moment still being kept from recognizing who they were really talking to. Verse 25, then he, Jesus, said to them, O foolish ones, and slow of heart to believe in all that the prophets have spoken. From the meanings of the adjectives foolish and slow and the verb or action word believe in this verse, it could be restated, O you who are lacking understanding and mentally slow to apprehend and place confidence in all that the prophets have spoken. Not a very flattering assessment to hear, but true nevertheless for them, and also true many times for us. As God's people today, we know the scriptures well, much like these two disciples. Also, much like them, we know what the scriptures say about the things that will happen in our personal spiritual journeys. We also know what the scriptures say about the many events that are yet to unfold in the overall plan of God for mankind. How am I? How are you at understanding, apprehending, placing confidence in all that the prophets have spoken, to the point that when that work in our lives or those events in the world are occurring, that we can clearly recognize what's happening right in front of us? It's probably an area where there's opportunity to grow for most of us, to put it charitably. Verse 26 I'm going to read the last two verses, verses 26 and 27, from the English Standard Version as well. Luke 24, verse 26. Jesus states, "Was it not necessary that the Christ should suffer these things and enter into his glory? And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted to them all in all the scriptures the things concerning himself." Now the word necessary in verse 26, as the English Standard Version has it, has deep meaning with this simple but profound statement by Jesus Christ. This word necessary implies necessity in reference to what is required to attain some end. As Mr. McNeely explained in his sermon last week, the end that was being attained through his sacrifice is our forgiveness, individual and collective. It is the ability for God to extend the opportunity for salvation and eternal life to mankind. The disciples had been surprised by his crucifixion and had seen the events surrounding it as an unexpected change of course. This statement made it clear that far from being expected, what had occurred was intended. More than that, the suffering was an imperative requirement for the Messiah to enter into his glory. It's easy for us to perceive many of the events within our lives and within the world as unexpected turns. Unexpected turns, a change of course from what should be happening. How often do we, much like the disciples here on the road to Emmaus, need a change of perspective? Many times, like them, we need God's help to recognize that the things occurring are, in fact, necessary. Now, does that mean that God intentionally causes everything that doesn't go the way that we hope it will in life? No, but in the big picture, he will use all of those things. He will use it all to fulfill his purpose for us. The word translated interpreted or expounded, as the New King James has it in verse 27, shows the vital role that God must play in our spiritual understanding. It describes unfolding the meaning of what is said by explaining. So you can visualize kind of a map or some other piece of paper that's folded up, and you have to unfold it and get a clear view of what's in front of you. That's what this word means. And it can also be used to represent the action of translating into one's native language. So translating words to make them able to be understood. The disciples' collective experience in these pivotal events shows the necessity of God coming alongside us, as he did with these disciples on the road to Emmaus. He physically came alongside them, and then he spiritually came alongside them. And we, just as much as them, need God to come alongside us and help us and open our minds and hearts. As we begin to conclude, let's review the final verse connected with the Passover that provides great hope. What we've reviewed today isn't meant in any way to be discouraging, but much rather, again, a step back, to take a step forward, a step back to gain perspective that will help in our spiritual development. We've seen that the disciples didn't very clearly grasp what was happening as the events of the Passover and the resurrection that followed unfolded in front of them. And they needed God to bring that element of understanding that they didn't have on their own. If we're honest, it's the same way for us many times in the events of our own lives and in the broader plan that God has. When events occur in plain sight, in our plain sight, but without being fully understood. We can take comfort and also a key motivator in pursuing spiritual development from Christ's words to Peter as he washed his feet. I'll read this from the English Standard Version as well, out of John 13. John 13, verse 6, he, Jesus, came to Simon Peter, who said to him, Lord, do you wash my feet? Verse 7, Jesus answered him, what I am doing you do not understand now, but afterward you will understand. You do not understand now, but afterward you will understand. I think, as we've seen here clearly, Jesus was speaking about the foot washing. After the foot washing, he began to explain what had happened to the disciples. But I think, as we've seen here, this statement also has a far broader meaning, extending into our own lives as it did for the disciples. Many things we don't understand clearly in the moment, but afterward we do. Jesus Christ already knew that the disciples wouldn't clearly understand, but he also knew that they would in the fullness of time. We can take immense comfort in the certainty that God knows us completely. He knows when we understand and when we don't. He knows what we're capable of and not capable of. So having recommitted to our covenant with God the Father and Jesus Christ by observing the Passover, during this Feast of Unleavened Bread, let's all ask God to help us see more clearly, to grasp more fully, and to grow in spiritual maturity more abundantly. Let's ask God to help transform our expectations and bring them into alignment with the work that he is doing in our lives and in the lives of all mankind.